Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
President Bush continues to not let facts get in the way of his ideology.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
Hello, good morning, good evening, wherever you are. It's time for another fun-filled edition of the Above Politics Show. I am Justin Case.
And I'm Martin Bain. And we have another extraordinary show lined up for you. Not that we want to give too much away just now. We want to keep you on your tender hooks, don't we, Justin? But we have another guest on the show, and we'll be listening to that guest later on. And before the interview comes out, between us, we will tell you who our special guest on the show is today.
Let's get through to this trivia challenge. I think I know the answer, and I want to see if anybody else got it.
My question was, what was the number of the United Nations Security Council resolution made fairly soon after Ian Smith declared UDI for Rhodesia? And the resolution number was 216, and TuneIn Spork got the answer right. And I believe there will be 500 points going to TuneIn Spork. He was slightly cruel to say it only took him 0.83 seconds to find the answer. So I think that's a lesson certainly for me, Justin, that maybe I need to try a little bit harder to make the questions more challenging for our listeners, you know, less than a second to find the answer.
Ah, see, you got to remember, we live in the century of Google. You can ask the question, that internet search engine will find the answer. We really should talk to them about being a sponsor of this show.
We should be, because I suspect most of the answers have probably appeared on Google, and I occasionally have checked Google to find the odd answer, and occasionally it's had to go to the second or third page, or somebody else must have used another search engine. But hey, good job, TuneIn Spork. Delighted that you listened to the show, because, hey, that shows you listen to the show. Well done, and I'm sure Mr. Rabbit will be along with your 500 points. And now, Justin.
The moment we've all been waiting for. Okay, well, here's one for you. And I just happen to know from the dossier that we keep in the vault over here that TuneIn Spork is a big techno buff. He knows everything there is to know about technology. So I figured that since he's so good at catching the answers for these things, that I'd hit him with a technical question that also has some pop culture elements to it. So here it is. If you are a computer on a popular 1980s science fiction show that aired in the United States and around the world, what is your name?
I'm sure there will be people, as soon as they hear the question, whilst they're listening to the show, they will Google, which I must give us have a little bit of a problem with, Justin, because I'd rather our listeners give our show full attention. But A, I will accept that.
Hey,
one.
Google that one if you can. See what you're missing, Martin, is the way that you word the questions. If you are a computer on a well-known, highly syndicated science fiction television show that was popular in the 1980s here in the United States, what is your name? See, I don't name the show. I don't name any of the actors. I'm just asking for that one specific tidbit of information. If you can Google that, then I says good luck.
Good luck. So, you know, you're obviously challenging him. You're obviously seeing that we didn't do very well last time around. And the other thing I did ask, I put in a rather frivolous challenge last time, because I know you and I were talking about, you know, what the U.S. presidential candidates might do to raise their profile. And we touched on the subject of them posing naked. And I did sort of ask, well, how much would you as a newspaper editor pay for them not to do that one? And TuneIn Spork was the only person that came back. But it would seem that there wasn't enough money that he would offer for this to happen. So it's a rather unpleasant thought, really, that, you know, our members would be quite happy to see John McCain or Barack Obama or the ex-presidential candidate Hillary Clinton with no clothes on. I'm not sure what that says about our audience, Justin.
Prurient interest, my friend. Prurient interest.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. And Just on another quick subject, in the show thread for show 19, we did put up a link following our interview with Simon Darby from the British National Party. So it's good to see that we are getting profile within our membership, but also that Simon Darby has a blog, and there were some very favourable comments on that particular blog about the quality of the show, which is not only down just to me and Justin, but to our listeners as well. We want to thank you very much for that one.
It's nice to get positive feedback whenever it can happen.
Certainly does. It certainly does.
With that positive feedback in mind, let's end the suspense. Tell our listeners who this week's guest is.
Yes, our special guest for this week is Rob Griffiths, who is the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Britain. So trying to bring maybe a little bit of balance. We've had the British National Party, who were on the right of English politics or British politics. Now we're going to listen to Rob Griffiths, who is from the Communist Party, who is on the left of British politics. So, Justin, no one can accuse us of not being balanced.
Well, that's true. And we talked about this for some time before we did it. And I just want our listeners to know that this was a deliberate choice. You can grab your radio dial and tune in to any number of programs that'll tell you anything you could ever want to know about American politics. But since this is largely an Amerocentric audience, we thought that in order to be different, we should bring you something different. So this is where we get the British stuff from.
Quite right. And I suppose it's worth saying that we welcome our listeners to suggest people from their own country or political parties, or maybe send us the contact details for political parties outside of the US and outside of the UK. Justin and I will go off and see if we can raise some interviews with them. I suppose really the only criterion we need to put down here, Justin, is that they can do the interview in English, because I suspect our language skills outside of English are probably a tad limited.
Oh, absolutely. I, unfortunately, have lost every bit of foreign language skill I ever picked up in college, so I'm back to being a single language speaker.
See, the thing is, you even learned some other languages. I didn't. Let's be brutal here. Why do I have to learn another language? And that's the shocking truth. And, you know, and if people disagree with me, tell me. But it is true. If you're English speaking, I can go to almost every country in the world, and there's a good probability I'm going to get someone who can talk English.
That is true. But I got to tell you, from my own perspective, it was a life-altering experience to learn another language, because as part of that language immersion process, you also get a peek at their logic process, because some languages arrange their word structures differently. It also gives you a clue as to how those people think.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, it just wasn't deemed that that was the thing you needed to do when I was growing up, being, you know, learning English. Rest of the world speaks English. Why do I need to try? And that's a shocking. It's shocking. It is absolutely shocking.
In today's politically correct world here in the United States, they have all kinds of different immersion programs that begin at the very earliest ages for today's kids. Kindergarten, first grade, second grade. They're hitting them with Chinese and Spanish. It's totally amazing.
And I absolutely agree with that. I think that's the right thing to do, and I applaud it. And, you know, if there are people out there who, you know, have the ability to learn languages, go ahead and do it. I think it's an absolutely tremendous thing, but I've had no reason to go out and do that one. And maybe someone ought to come around to me and say, you can learn another language. I really think that I don't really need to learn another language, so therefore there's no motivation for me to do it. And that's the shocking truth, Justin. There's no reason for me to go out and learn another language.
Well, there may be no reason for you to learn another language, but when we come back from this break, our interview will introduce you to another political ideology. Now, it may sound like Martian, but I guarantee you that it's not. This is good old-fashioned Earth politics with a different spin.
Hey, everyone. Doc Hancock here from the BTS Mix Show. The BTS Mix is a lot of fun, but when I need some serious mental stimulation, I know exactly where to go. Our sister shows here at the Above Network LLC. Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous over at the ATS Mix Show tackle a variety of current topics, ranging from hard-hitting events in the news to conspiracy theories to the mysterious world of UFOs. Here you'll find insightful discussions about member posts, member interviews, and exclusive interviews with experts in their fields. To quench my political cravings, I tune into the Above Politics show with Martin Bain and Justin Case. Martin and Justin make sense out of this crazy political climate by discussing member posts, interviewing members about their stances on the issues, and interviewing noted political figures and authors. For politics, there is nowhere else to turn. So come on over and deny boredom with us at the BTS Mix Show, featuring Spencer Tracy and me, Doc Hancock. Deny ignorance with the ATS Mix Show with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous, and deny apathy with the Above Politics Show with Martin Bain and Justin Case. Be a part of the revolution. It's Above Network, LLC.
And welcome back. You're listening to the Above Politics Show, and on the line we have our special guest interviewer for today, and he is Rob Griffiths, and he is the Secretary General of the Communist Party of Britain. How are you doing, Rob?
I'm okay. I think they might call it the Secretary General in somewhere like France, but of course in Britain we call it General Secretary.
Golly. Golly. Thank you very much. Always pick me up if we make a mistake here. So I didn't know if you just wanted to maybe spend a couple of minutes and just sort of talk about the Communist Party of Britain. Just give us maybe a quick history, because I know you have been working on, and I think you've written a couple of volumes already of the history of the Communist Party of Britain, and you're working on another one. So probably the ideal man to talk about the history and where the Communist Party of Britain came from.
Well, I'm certainly working with somebody else on the next volume. I didn't have the privilege of writing the previous four, but we are preparing now the fifth volume in the history of our party. The Communist Party in Britain was actually formed in 1920. It is one of the oldest communist parties in the world, and of course we created the party in the fallout from the Great War, the huge slaughter of the First World War, and in solidarity, obviously, with the Russian Revolution and the Soviet Republic that was being established at that time. The party, although small, was very active, very militant, played quite a very active role in the industrial battles of the 1920s. About 12 leading members of the Communist Party of Great Britain were actually imprisoned on the eve of the general strike. The British government was very keen to get them out of the way before that enormous battle commenced. So they were locked up on various trumped-up charges of conspiracy and sedition and so on. In the 1930s, the party obviously was very much to the fore in the battle against fascism, against the British variety of Sir Oswald Mosley. I think another characteristic of the Communist Party in Britain throughout its history has been our involvement in the struggles of peoples in the British Empire, as it then was, for their liberation. From the very beginning, the Communist Party in Britain stood for the freedom of the colonial peoples, and we were engaged in all sorts of activities, some of them not entirely legal, to assist those peoples in India and Africa and elsewhere in their fight for national independence. Of course, we were very active in the Second World War, calling for the Second Front in Europe against German fascism. The Cold War took its toll on us, the enormous amount of anti-communist propaganda that we faced in Britain, never quite on the scale of the United States, but still very substantial. Purges in a number of the trade unions, in the civil service, and so on. But nevertheless, our party survived and played a very, very prominent role in a number of key trade unions. And I suppose, through its history, our party has always had a certain base in the trade union movement, in the various anti-war movements from time to time, and as well in other battles, battles over council housing, campaign for the National Health Service, campaigns against racism, and so on, for equal pay for women. We're proud of the record of the Communist Party in Britain, despite some of our mistakes, despite some of the things that we got wrong, some of our wrong assessments, and so on. Nevertheless, we do believe that we have stood on the side of ordinary people. We've stood for greater democracy. We've stood for equal rights for women, for black people, and so on. And we've always fought for fairness at work, for decent wages, for public ownership of key industries and services and so on. And that's obviously that will be reflected, as well as criticisms of some of our mistakes over the years, but that will be reflected in the history that I'll be helping others to write over the coming period as well.
How did you personally become involved in the British Communist Party?
Well, in fact, I actually started off 40 years ago now as a Labour Party supporter, like many people in Britain, but particularly in the area of Britain that I come from, Wales and South Wales. So I was a Labour supporter. I suppose I would have called myself a socialist from quite an early age. I never actually got round to joining the Labour Party. I was actually attracted initially by Plaid Cymru, the Welsh National Party, which had quite a left-wing image and so on at that time. So the first political party I joined was, in fact, Plaid Cymru, the Welsh Nationalist Party. I came to believe that that was not going to play any significant role in the battle for a socialist society. I was also an internationalist, as well as somebody who felt strongly that Wales should have its own parliament and rights for the Welsh language and so on. So I did gravitate. I mean, I had quite good relations with the Communist Party, even when I worked full-time for Plaid Cymru. And that was one of the things that appealed to me about the CP, as we've always called it, that it's always worked very hard at developing friendly relations with other people, like-minded people, people with progressive views, people who may not have agreed with a whole number of things the Communist Party stood for, but might have seen eye to eye with it on a number of key issues. I was always impressed by that style of work, that the Communists in Wales and in Britain were always very open. They always sought the areas of agreement rather than emphasizing the areas of difference. So I actually ended up joining the party after the defeat of the referendum for a Welsh Assembly in 1979, the election of a Tory government, and the belief that I believed it was essential, not just for people in Wales, but for people across Britain, to have a consistent, principled socialist party. And, you know, that is how I'd already come to regard the Communist Party. In fact, for quite a few years before I eventually joined it in 1983.
Okay, and what's sort of the political base of the Communist Party today? I mean, I don't think there's a communist MP, but presumably there are communist councillors?
We haven't had a communist MP since the late 1940s. There have been a number of communist MPs from time to time in Britain. But, you know, given the nature of our electoral system, given the weight of Cold War propaganda and so on, the cards have always been stacked against the Communist Party electorally. And the fact that the trade unions, many of the trade unions, of course, are affiliated to the Labour Party. So that's always made it very difficult. We only have one or two parish councillors at the moment, local community councillors. We don't have any MPs. And it would be true to say we don't actually place a lot of our resources in the electoral battle, although we do contest elections and we think that's very important. It can't be the highest priority for us because, as I say, you know, we tend to be quite outgunned by the other parties in terms of publicity, resources, and so on. It's an area we have expanded in recent years. And in fact, where we stand and where we're able to mount a reasonable campaign, quite often we find that we get anything from 5 to 25% of the votes, in very local circumstances. But that's the position at the moment. We've expanded our electoral work, but I couldn't say it's our highest priority. I think our work in the trade union movement, in the peace movement, in the pensioners movement, and so on, these are areas where we're able to win a lot of friends, a lot of allies, and contribute to the policy making and contribute to the leadership of the mass movements that we have in Britain in those different areas.
We've asked some members some questions on AboveTopSecret.com, and there's sort of been certainly through a couple of them, certainly from one member called certainly Sty and another member, Infinite, were sort of just talking about there could be a perception that, say, communism in the Eastern Bloc and maybe in China and North Korea hasn't been seen in the most favourable light because of the say the Western view of the oppression of the people in those countries. So I suppose I've got a two-part question: is how much would you see yourself tied up or allied with that type of communism? And then just to sort of comment on sort of the perception that those countries have been fairly harsh on their people.
Well, I'm certainly not going to dodge the difficult questions because we have carried out our own extensive discussions on the questions of socialism as it existed in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, its shortcomings, its mistakes, in fact, even its crimes from time to time. We've also, mind, considered its positive achievements, which, of course, have never received any publicity at all in the West. But I think I would start by saying that the international communist movement has always been much, much more than just the leading parties in a number of countries. Now, obviously, the Soviet Union as a superpower meant that the role of the Soviet Communist Party was always a very substantial one. And it's true to say that we stood in solidarity with the positive achievements of the Soviet Union, and we were late to recognize some of the very serious deficiencies and mistakes. But I think even before, you know, getting deeper into that particular aspect, I think it should be remembered the communist movement across the world also includes the Communist Party in South Africa, which fought such a magnificent battle against apartheid throughout its history and is now a party of government with mass support. It's the Communist Party of Brazil. It's the Communist Party of Chile that resisted the Pinochet dictatorship. It's the Communist Party of France and Greece and Italy that formed powerful partisan movements against fascism and the restoration of democracy after the Second World War. It's the communist movement is made up of parties around the world that have many great achievements, I think, to their credit in terms of defending human rights, defending democracy, seeking a better life for the masses of ordinary people. Now, that doesn't absolve us from the mistakes that we have made in being uncritical at times in the past about the weaknesses and failings of socialism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. But I would say the two things, I think, in conclusion. First of all, the international communist movement has always been much more than a number of parties in power. And secondly, that the positive achievements of those regimes also have to be put into the balance against the negative aspects of them. And I'm more than happy to talk about those at greater length if you think that would be useful for your listeners.
Can you give us a short list of what you think some of the greater communist mistakes have been in the past?
Well, I'm happy to talk about the mistakes, but I think as well, I would preface them very briefly by saying, for example, in the Soviet Union, a semi-feudal, semi-capitalist, and in many respects very backward dictatorship, royalist dictatorship of the secret police and the anti-Semitic programs and all the rest of it, that was transformed by Soviet socialism into a modern scientific society with free education and health for all, with a great amount of economic and social and cultural development. And that was done in a very, very short time in historical terms. It was also done without an enormous empire, without a slave trade, without the other things that, in fact, enabled the older capitalist countries to develop. So, I'm certainly more than prepared to acknowledge the terrible mistakes that were made in the Soviet Union, but I would have to preface them by the great historical positive aspects that are so often and quite deliberately overlooked. Let's not also forget, of course, that if it wasn't for the Soviet Union and the role that it played in the Second World War, where four-fifths of the Second World War was actually fought on the Eastern Front between Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia, we wouldn't even be having this interview in German today. People like me would have been wiped out a long time ago. And not just me, but liberals, Democrats, socialists, and people of conscience and so on. So, in a nutshell, I think, are some of the positive things. The negative things, well, of course, I think increasingly over time, the Soviet Republic, surrounded as it was by hostile forces, including the invasion of its territory immediately after the revolution by 14 Western armies, including British and American troops, but you don't find much about that in the history books. I think that the fact that the Soviet Republic had to battle against a hostile world to survive, I think that strengthened the sort of conservative and authoritarian elements in the Soviet Communist Party and in the regime. And I think it reached the point in the end where the internal democracy that undoubtedly had existed in the Communist Party under Lenin, I think that, that gradually was snuffed out. And instead of there being the great ferment of debate and new ideas and experimentation, I think Soviet society became increasingly centralized. The regime became increasingly authoritarian, resorting to repressive tactics rather than to political methods to resolve differences and so on. And of course, it did end in the terrible paranoia of the purges of the 1930s, not forgetting, of course, that the vast majority of the victims of those purges were communists, and that period was a very bad blot on the record of socialism. We've seen far worse in the capitalist world, but nevertheless, that was certainly a period when some great crimes were committed and terrible mistakes were made. And I think Soviet society never fully recovered from that, even though things did ease and there was a great thaw in the later 1950s and 60s and so on. Nevertheless, I think the way in which Soviet society became a society where diktats were issued by a centralized leadership from above, the mass of people were not genuinely involved in political debate, in the management of their enterprises, in decision-making of any kind. And the Soviet Union ended up paying the price for that. And you have a society in which innovation and debate and experimentation are discouraged and sometimes even punished. That means it's a society in which it's very difficult for new ideas to develop and new techniques to be developed and applied and so on. And of course, we had similar purges in Eastern Europe. Undoubtedly, some Western intelligence agencies contributed to that, to the paranoia that that gripped those countries, particularly in the late 1940s. But nevertheless, again, the show trials were a mockery of socialism and of socialist democracy. And once more, too many of those societies based themselves on the Soviet model, the centralized authoritarian rule from above model, instead of a model that placed much greater trust in the mass of the people, who after all were supposed to be the ones in power in a socialist society. So I think we have to look at those periods. I think we have to be honest about the mistakes. I don't pay serious attention to a lot of the Western propaganda about all of that, with the grossly inflated figures and the self-righteous denunciations and so on. But certainly, there were serious mistakes made, and socialists and communists have to learn from those mistakes so that the next time the opportunity arises, whether in Venezuela or Bolivia or South Africa or wherever it may be, or China, the next time the opportunity arises to build a different kind of society, we make sure we don't commit the same mistakes that were made previously.
In today's world, if there were a true communist society, Martin and I would probably be hungry.
Well, the nearest we can get. I mean, countries try and develop a new society in very different conditions on the basis of very different traditions and opportunities and so on. But certainly, I think there are many positive things in the Cuban model that have been developed as far as a socialist society is concerned. I think they have avoided some of the worst aspects of the Soviet model and the Eastern European model. But of course, Cuba's possibilities at the moment are limited by the fact that it is still essentially a third world developing country. And of course, they've tried to build an alternative society, and I think to some extent succeeded, despite having the world's greatest superpower on its as its next door neighbor, doing everything possible to undermine and sabotage that revolution. It's the old story, if you were to ask a socialist or a communist earlier in the century, where do you want to start building socialism? I don't think many of us would have chosen either Russia in 1917 or even Cuba in 1959. I think we were we rather believed it might come in a more advanced type of society with a real opportunity to develop free of enormous interference by hostile powers. But there we are. Life doesn't turn out exactly as you might like it.
One of the things I'm interested in is that I sort of look in and see there's probably been a movement around the world of potentially where communism was, and you'd say in the 60s and 70s it was in what we regarded as Eastern Europe, Rob, but today my perception would be a lot more that there's probably more ferment of communism, say, in South America. And I'm just sort of curious to see what your views or what you think of the sort of migration of, say, communism around the world.
Well, firstly, there's no doubt that you know, because the parties in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union had state power, it meant that everything was overshadowed by them to some extent. But there have always been, you know, there have been communist parties and movements in other parts of the world from around 1920 as well, sometimes a little later. And I had the enormous good fortune to go to Venezuela just over a year ago to the most recent Congress of the Venezuelan Communist Party, which has grown enormously in the conditions that have opened up in Venezuela. It was a party that was illegal. It's been illegal for most of its existence. It's now able to function openly. It's democratically elected to the National Assembly. And I saw the most vibrant, exciting, and democratic Congress. It was absolutely phenomenal. Thousands of people, fierce debate at times, but also great camaraderie, great excitement, but also a certain, I think, sobriety about the difficulties of trying to build a socialist society in Venezuela in its current conditions. But nevertheless, they have a few advantages, and they've decided to embark on that particular road. In countries like that, in Brazil, in Uruguay, in Bolivia, as I said earlier, in South Africa, in India, in fact, you've got one of the biggest communist parties in the world in India that already runs three states with populations far greater than the population of Eastern Europe. And they've been re-elected with enormous majorities since the 1960s. So again, they must be doing something right. And it's true that, I think now that we've had the collapse of the regimes in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, we are seeing in the light of what's happened since, you know, we never got the peace dividend, did we? We haven't seen all of the other benefits that were supposed to come our way once the Warsaw Pact collapsed and so on. And I think in the kind of world that has developed since then, a very insecure world with enormous problems that big business and big governments don't have any intention of trying to tackle, I think in those circumstances it's inevitable that there will be in many places a turn to the left. And usually that includes as well that the Communist Party grows.
One of the things I'm interested in, you've always spoken about Soviet communism. And I'm interested in what you see. Are there differences between the sort of model of communism that was the Eastern Bloc, Soviet, Cuban model and, say, the Chinese model?
Well, I mean, I've been careful always to describe those societies as societies that are building socialism, which is how they've always described themselves. It's only in the West that we talk about these being communist societies and how they fall short and so on. No, they're building socialism, and that is being attempted in very, very different conditions. I mean, for example, the Chinese model, if you like to call it that, of the kind of society they're seeking to build and how they're seeking to do it is very different from the Soviet model. Some of the Eastern European models, such as in Yugoslavia, was very different from the Soviet model. I'm quite sure that the model being developed in Venezuela will have its own unique features. Certainly Cuba. Cuba has gone about building socialism in a very different way and in very different circumstances to the Soviet Union and China. So, you know, sometimes I think that, you know, the great variety that is there is overlooked because, of course, Western propaganda usually wants to present a single monolithic model and then highlight any negative features and then invent quite a few on top of that and present it all as a disastrous tyranny. But of course, anybody who goes to Cuba or goes to China and so on and wanders around and speaks to people, which you're entirely free to do, by the way. Anybody who does that quickly realizes that these societies are very different to one another. They're very different to the old societies in the Soviet Union and the Czech Republic, which I went to, and so on. You know, these are all very different models. The Chinese model is unique. It has some features that British communists have always been very uneasy about, that were criticized in the past and so on. But at the same time, you know, they've also got their own particular features. And certainly to have ensured that a population that you can count in billions actually doesn't starve, I mean, that might not seem a marvelous achievement to us here in Britain or in the United States, but the reality is, of course, that many people in the Third World go hungry, and many people starve, and many people suffer from terrible disasters that we call natural disasters, but in fact, I'm afraid human exploitation contributes to them very significantly. Well, in China, they are trying their best to build a society using methods that are a little unusual for socialists and communists, but they've also ensured that their people are fed and clothed and educated, and you're talking about you're talking about at least one-fifth of the population of the planet, and even that is an enormous achievement in such a short period of time. But again, the model of socialism that we would develop in Britain or in the United States, come to that, would have its own very unique features, and I think just to try and copy some other model, I think, is a big mistake, and it's one of the lessons to learn from the past.
And just touching on that, we've got a question from a member, Fred 3110. His sort of question was, how would a communist model be implemented in the UK? And he sort of goes on to sort of just add a little bit to that, Rob, and he sort of wants to bring into that, when the economic and cultural differences between the peoples in Britain are blindingly obvious, so would it be possible for a communist model to actually establish itself in the UK, and how would you see, potentially, if it does happen, and you start winning elections, then theoretically you could become would you be the Prime Minister? I'm not sure what the correct title would be to describe you as, so you don't get into trouble with the other people in your party,
No. Well, I think the first thing I would say to Fred again is that we don't actually talk about the communist model for Britain or anywhere else for that matter. We talk about building a socialist society. And for us in Britain to build a socialist society, I think it's highly unlikely that the circumstances would be such that it would be done mainly or only by the Communist Party. Britain will only take the road to socialism when a clear majority of its people want to do so. I think they would find ways of expressing that that would not involve necessarily electing the Communist Party to be the leading party or the main party. It might be the Labour Party or some version of that. And socialism would have to be built by consent, and it would have to involve a wide range of different organisations, movements, forces, parties, and so on. We certainly don't see the conditions in which it would be the Communist Party that decrees the building of socialism. In terms of Britain, well, of course, one of the things that attracted me to the Communist Party in Britain was that almost alone on the left, the Communist Party has always taken the national claims and the national rights of the different peoples of Britain very seriously, and has argued for a Scottish Parliament and a Welsh Parliament for 50 years, a long time before those policies began to have any real echo in the Labour Party. And therefore, at the moment, we call for a federal Britain. We think that is the best way to arrange a good relationship between the different nations of Britain. And we would see those different nations of Britain having much greater power to determine their own affairs. But we also believe the unity we've built up in the trade union movement, in the Labour and Progressive movements, in the Communist Party and so on, we think that unity would be necessary.
I've got one last question for you as we wrap things up here. In all of the countries where communist ideology holds sway today, Martin and I would be in their gulags or their prisons. So
I doubt that very much. I can't imagine why that would be the case.
Martin?
Why do you feel that way? You know, if you were journalists in Cuba or journalists in China, there are many journalists in those countries, provided you're not an agent for a hostile foreign power, I don't see any reason why that would be the case. A lot of people, many people in China, are not communists or in Cuba, but they're relatively free, certainly by third world standards. They're relatively free to speak their mind, to argue, to write, and so on. Now, of course, in Britain, I think our democratic rights are greater. We fought for them over a longer period of time. But, I mean, the most dangerous places to be a journalist in the world are certainly not in the socialist countries, the few socialist countries that we have. You know, there aren't death squads in Cuba or in China or in Vietnam that go around targeting and killing journalists. I think you'll find that happens in Iraq, it happens in Somalia, it happens in Latin America, it happens in other parts of Africa, and it's usually the supposed champions of freedom who are involved in snuffing out independent free journalism. So, I believe, and I think you would probably prosper in a socialist society, and certainly if that were not the case, it's not a socialist society worth having.
If our members wanted to know more information about the Communist Party of Britain, is there a website they could go to, Rob?
Yes, they would be very welcome to visit our website at www.communist-party.org.uk, and you'll find our policies there. You'll find our links to many of the communist and workers' parties around the world. You'll find something of our publications, of our history, and so on. And I hope that your listeners will take advantage of that and hear what communism itself has to say for itself rather than what its enemies have to say about it, which unfortunately is the only source that most people have ever been allowed to have in a Western society.
Well, that's sort of for Justin and I, Rob, that's sort of the mandate of the show, is to go above politics, and we're, you know, one of my remits, and I hope Justin would agree, to sort of bring different views to our membership. So I certainly do appreciate the time you've given us today. It's been certainly interesting, it's been educational for me to understand more about the Communist Party of Great Britain. So maybe sometime in the future, could we get you back on the show sometime?
I thank you very much. I'd be delighted. I appreciate the opportunity, and I just hope now you can persuade the BBC to lift its ban on the Communist Party so that people can hear on the BBC what the Communist Party actually has to say and what its policies really are.
They haven't been returning our calls lately.
Well, you obviously take your investigative journalism too seriously. And I congratulate you on that.
Well, hey, thank you very much. We appreciate your time, and we'd certainly welcome the opportunity at some stage to get you back on the show.
That's very kind of you. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
And we'll be right back after a brief and stylish interlude.
Being part of the revolution is easy. Star, flag, and dig the mother. Whether you find a great topic or really enjoy one of our podcasts, you can make it even better by taking the time to show your appreciation and applause by giving the material a star, then flag, and finally a dig. This will draw attention to the thread or podcast, and by doing so, you're making a difference and improving the ATS, BTS, and Above Politics experience. So remember, when you find a great thread or podcast, star, flag, and dig the mother. Thanks for being part of the revolution from your friends at the Above Networks, LLC.
Well, that was an informative interview. As a child of the Cold War, I was certainly ready to take issue with a great deal of what he said. But, you know, Martin, part of what we're supposed to do here is we're supposed to let these people say what they think in their own words. And I think we hit the ball out of the park on this one.
I absolutely think so. And, yeah, sort of from my perspective, it's good to sort of have the opposite ends, I see, of British politics. Week before last, we interviewed the guys from the British National Party, and this week we've interviewed the people from the Communist Party of Britain. And I like that because they're typically not views that typically get a lot of airtime, Justin. So, yeah, I like to do that. I like to bring these views to people. And, you know, we only have to look at, you know, some of the show threads for our last interview with the British National Party. You know, we generated a lot of comments there. And people, we appreciate that one. You know, we like you to get involved. Find the show thread in abovetopsecret.com, ATS Mix. If you like things, tell us. If you don't like things, tell us. And clearly, you know, hopefully we'll bring you some more insightful interviews in the future.
Yes, indeed. Now, if you want to take issue with what this guy said, you will actually be able to do it now, point by point, specifically because you heard him in his own words.
Absolutely, and that's so important. So.
All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for us today. So on behalf of everybody behind the scenes here at the Above Network LLC and the Above Politics Show, I am Justin Case.
And I'm Martin Bain, and we'll see you next time on the Above Politics Show.
You've been listening to the Above Politics Show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com. The views expressed on the Above Politics Show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.